Yeah, so it's sort of like a miniature CIA, and it performs a lot of the same analytic functions. So my office was responsible for assessing strategic intentions and military capabilities of all of the countries in the Middle East, figuring out what they were going to do and what the status of their armed forces were. So right now, they're probably looking very closely at how many Iranian missiles and Navy assets and other strategic assets are left.
And can you talk about during the U.S. war on Iraq, when the U.S. invaded, Bush would always talk, President George W. Bush, about the coalition of the willing. To say the least, we're talking about at this moment, doesn't look like there's any coalition. You have Italy saying, and this is a right leader of Italy, right, Giorgia Meloni, diplomacy needs to prevail. Estonia, when talking about this coalition, it's a bit rich. Spain, the objective must be for the war to end. Australia, we won't be sending a ship to the Strait of Hormuz. Germany, it's not NATO's war. The significance of Trump first castigating all these allies and then saying they have to do something here, and they saying they won't.
Yeah, I mean, and just historically, it takes a lot for European leaders not to follow the U.S. into a Middle East intervention. If you look at Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and the general complacency there. So I think this is the latest fissure Trump is creating in the NATO alliance and the U.S.-Europe relationship, where he's transgressed so much that Europeans are not willing to assist. But I do want to note that that the U.S. Navy, U.S. has more aircraft carriers than all of these countries combined. The help from European countries, I think, would be much more symbolic than actually materially necessary to change the course of this war.
And in your former agency, the DIA, you were tasked with understanding and developing military strategy. To what level of a strategic blunder do you consider what has happened here with this war in Iran, historically speaking, in terms of the U.S. And its military?
Yeah, I think on the American side, it's just totally strategically bankrupt. Again, no plan after the first 24 hours when it didn't immediately turn into Venezuela with a seemingly successful regime replacement operation. And we've seen them really just throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks, right? It was less than 2 weeks ago that Trump policy was try to foment a Kurdish uprising and fracture Iran, right? They abandoned that in like 48 hours. Now we're seeing him basically try and do policy by tweet and seeing if Europeans are willing to bail him out. Amy, as you mentioned, they're absolutely not. And I think it's important to note that Donald Trump was probably surprised by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, by the attacks on all the Gulf states, by the skyrocketing oil prices. And we're also going to see foodstuffs go up because 30% of the world's fertilizer goes to the Strait of Hormuz as well. But the people who drove him into this war are not dumb and very much expected this. I don't think this is a surprise to Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, or Benjamin Netanyahu, who is very much getting what he wanted, which is dragging the U.S. into what he hopes will be a decisive war of annihilation against Iran.
And of course, this is an election year, and the concern about the level of danger the U.S. troops face, not to mention others, but I mean, 200 troops injured, 13 dead. Over the weekend, the Pentagon named 6 U.S. service members who were killed when their military refueling plane crashed in Iraq last week. The family of Technical Sergeant Tyler Simmons, including his grandma, spoke to NBC in Columbus, Ohio. They criticized the war on Iran.
This could have been prevented. We didn't need to be in this war. You know, this is uncalled for, and this is what we get.
Families are suffering right now. Not only our family, but there are other families that's lost loved ones. And just to create a war because you want to create a war, it's not right.
The grandmother of one of the servicemen who was killed. In the last 30 seconds we have, Harrison Mann, when President Trump was asked on Air Force One about these latest 6 dead service members, he said, next question. He wouldn't even answer it. The significance of the lack of support for this war at home, even among the military?
Yeah, I think that's the effect of really clear strategic and tactical negligence when it comes to putting our troops in harm's way, right? Strategic negligence, like the very brave parents of this deceased pilot said, sending them into harm's way for no good reason, no reason to really explain why their son died. And then on the tactical level, we've also sent them to war without really obvious protections that could have saved lives. The first six service members who died were killed by a drone, basically inside of a trailer. No overhead protection, no very rudimentary precautions that could have maybe saved their lives. So, unfortunately, Trump and Hegseth aren't really hiding that they're not concerned about how many lives they spend while they try to figure out what they're doing in Iran.
And former U.S. Army major who resigned in 2024 from the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon's CIA, over the Biden administration's policy in Gaza, now a senior fellow at Win Without War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Cuba plunged into an island-wide blackout, leaving millions of people without power after the national electricity grid completely collapsed Monday. This was at least the third and the largest blackout to hit Cuba in just about 4 months, as the U.S. energy blockade has cut off the island from accessing desperately needed fuel. No oil shipments have reached Cuba in more than 3 months, according to the Cuban government, compounding a humanitarian crisis caused by decades of U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported Monday, Trump's negotiators told their Cuban counterparts during recent talks that Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel must be removed from power. President Trump spoke to reporters at the White House Monday.
I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be good honor. It's a big honor.
Taking Cuba.
Taking Cuba in some form, yeah. Taking Cuba. I mean, whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth?
Whether I free it, take it, or can do anything I want with it, President Trump says. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Havana, we go to Danielle Montero, Cuban journalist and producer with Belly of the Beast, an independent media outlet covering the impact of U.S. sanctions on Cuba. And in San Diego, California, we go to Sarah Cozume, assistant professor in history at University of California, San Diego, who's just returned from Cuba. Her recent piece for The Guardian headlined, "In the other U.S. target of regime change, Cuba, I saw real hardship and resilience." But Danielle, let's turn to you right now in Cuba. Talk about this largest blackout that we have seen, what it means for the people, what it means for Cuba, and what's happening.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I mean, what's really heartbreaking about this latest blackouts that we have is that at this point, for our daily lives, it doesn't feel any, that much different from normal days. What I'm trying to say is because now fuel is coming in, I mean, blackouts have extended significantly over the past few months. Right now in Havana, which usually fares a lot better than the rest of the country, we're talking about, at least 12 hours a day. You go to the provinces, outside of the city where my family lives, they're getting by with 3, 4, 5 hours a day. So, of course, a national blackout has tremendous impact throughout, but what I'm trying to convey is that because blackouts have extended so much due to the oil blockade, it doesn't feel that different. Right now, the power grid is coming back on. It usually takes them about a whole day to bring it entirely throughout the country. And authorities have said that precisely because there's less fuel, it takes them longer to bring back the grid. And of course, the consequences of this, not just the national blackout, but the oil blockade as a whole, it's tremendous. I think for the first time in my life, the sanctions feel completely unavoidable. I think you cannot find someone in Cuba that's not being affected by the current state of affairs.
And Daniel, what about the fact that even Latin American countries that have had long relations with Cuba and have progressive governments like Brazil and Mexico and are also oil exporters, that they have not stepped forward more strongly to assist Cuba with oil?
I think that just speaks to the world we're living in. right? I mean, Trump has exerted all of the pressure he can on other countries, and sadly, it has worked so far. And we're just living through the results. Of course, it saddens me as a Cuban. I suffer it every day. You know, this is not some abstract or theoretical notion for me. You know, we suffer it every day, and it's terrible. I mean, we're talking about, I have no other way to describe it, as sanctions are literally killing people right now, you know, because the conditions are so bad. And this has everything, absolutely everything to do with what the U.S. is doing to my country.
And how do you react to this announcement of the Cuban government that it will now be allowing Cuban Americans to own businesses and invest in the island?
I think that is actually a news that was rather positively received by people in Cuba. I mean, you have to understand that over the past 15 years, the country has been progressively opening up to investment coming from the outside and also from the inside of the country. So that is actually something that that didn't necessarily surprise anyone listening to the news, and that most people have no problem with.
And what President Trump said from the Oval Office, Danielle, how it's being received in Cuba, that the U.S., that President Trump would take it or free it or whatever, but that that's going to happen very soon. And the demand that the Cuban president, Díaz-Canel, must leave.
It is absolutely outrageous. I mean, we're talking about the idea of a negotiation or a talk between two countries cannot start with the premise of one of the parties stepping out. So if the goal was to actually come to an agreement and to actually improve the lives of the Cuban people, then that would not be the premise. But of course, this does not surprise us. We understand what this oil embargo means and what it has always meant, what sanctions have always meant. This is regime change through starvation. That is what they're trying to do. And right now, with the oil blockade, the conditions are worse than they ever have been. So, you know, as a Cuban, as someone living here, all of my family is here, it is absolutely outrageous to listen to, you know, Donald Trump and the administration in the United States saying that they're trying to help Cuba. They're trying to liberate Cuba because they don't articulate the price that they're asking people to pay. Sure, they're saying that they want freedom, they want democracy, they talk about all of these good things that are going to bring to the Cuban people, but they should really articulate the means to get there. The means to get there is the Cuban people suffering, is the Cuban people dying.
Have you experienced in Cuba, we have the reports of a magnitude 5.8 earthquake this morning on top of the national blackout?
Yes, in the east of the country, it is not very uncommon to have this these quakes. Fortunately, they don't usually actually cause that much damage out there. But, you know, at this point, it's just feel like, what else is going to happen? You know, I look back at, you know, in January, I found myself at home, you know, Maduro's abduction had just happened. And, you know, the idea of an actual U.S. invasion to Cuba for the first time became very real in my head. And we happened to live very close to a military base here in Havana. And I found myself having a conversation with my wife and, you know, basically just thinking, what room in the house do you think we would survive if they bomb? And by the end of the conversation, we're just looking at each other and going like, can you believe we're even having this conversation? And I think that's just the general feeling of being in Cuba right now with everything that's coming from Washington. What else is going to happen? When is this going to stop?
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Sarah Cosima, assistant professor in history at the University of California, San Diego. Professor, you've visited Cuba over the years, particularly in the rural parts of the country. You recently returned from Cuba. Could you talk about what you saw and the conditions there?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And I'd just like to say my experience is very consistent with what Daniel was just explaining. You know, the East is much farther from the ports in which petroleum and food arrives. And so they have fewer resources. The situation is much harder. There have been prolonged blackouts that have lasted many hours more than they've lasted in Havana for months now, but those have gotten worse in the last few weeks. So when I was there, they were getting maybe 16 hours of blackouts and maybe twice a day, 3 hours of electricity. And in, within the period that I was there, it was reduced to maybe 3 hours of electricity a day. And right now it seems that people have gone at least 25 hours, 26 hours since electricity at this point.
I want to ask Danielle about the response of the Cuban people. Obviously, like we saw it with Iran, I mean, you have the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, you know, urging people to rise up in Iran. He says you can, you know, take people to water, but you can't make them drink. President Trump was urging that. What do you see happening? Are people angrier at the United States or at the Cuban government at this point?
I think when you're hungry, your politics are, I want food. You know, I think for the majority of people, that's what they're feeling. Look, I don't see that, you know, the goal that the U.S. is trying to achieve here, which is the majority of the people rising up, that simply hasn't happened. There are minor protests, you know, when the blackouts happen, but that's been happening for the past 5 years. That is not new. So, like, that change that, you know, the U.S. is hoping to achieve in Cuba is simply not happening right now. I think people are very aware of what's going on, and they're, you know, paying the price of the decisions that have been made, but they're more concerned with what do I do today, what do I eat tonight, than anything else. Because as I said, you know, when your concerns are as pressing as those, that is the extent of your politics.
And I wanted to ask also, Professor Kazuma, this Trump claim that that the leadership of Cuba must change, that he will decide, this absolute narcissism of our president, that he decides, that he's the one that makes change in every one of these countries. Your sense of how this is being received among the Cuban people?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's not being received well. When I was there just a few weeks ago, I spoke to many people and I asked them straight up, like, what do you want to happen? What would you like to see? And even people who have, you know, who were vocal critics of the political system, and some who were less vocal critics of the political system, nobody agreed with what Trump was doing, none of them. And so I think, you know, Cubans are a highly educated population. They have access to the news. They understand the maneuvers. They understand the tactics. And I think right now they're feeling really blindsided. They just, you know, it was confirmed on Friday that they that the government is in negotiations with the United States. And so the process of sort of like understanding and processing that was just beginning on Monday, yesterday, when this announcement happened. And I think, you know, multiple people told me with outright anger in their voices that they wouldn't allow this, something like this, that they would fight back. So, you know, ultimately, Cubans have fought for sovereignty many, many times. And it doesn't seem that they're going to just sort of lie there while this is happening again.
We just have a minute, and I want to go back to Danielle in Havana, Cuba, about this convoy that is headed to Cuba. Many groups involved, including Progressive International, Code Pink. How much of a difference at this point does international solidarity mean?
I would argue that international solidarity is now more important than ever, especially coming from the United States, because, I mean, what everyone is hearing about Cuba is this oil embargo, is how everything is so bad in the country. I mean, the idea of having people coming over and showing a different face coming from the United States and showing that you know, we can still help each other. I think this is, I would argue Cuba has needed solidarity for a while now, but it certainly needs it right now. In terms of difference it can actually make, I mean, it depends on what they bring in. We need everything that anyone can bring in at this moment. But I think the most important part is the symbolic value of having all of these people coming over and showing their support for the Cuban people to fight the narrative that's coming from the Trump administration.
Danielle Montero, I want to thank you for being with us, Cuban journalist, producer with the independent media outlet Belly of the Beast, joining us from Havana, Cuba, and Sarah Cozumel. assistant professor in history, University of California, San Diego. We'll link to your piece in the other U.S. target of regime change, Cuba. I saw real hardship and resilience. Coming up, 8 anti-ICE protesters have been convicted on terrorism charges for taking part in a demonstration outside the Prairieland ICE jail in Texas. They each face up to 15 or at least 15 years in prison. Back in 20 seconds. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Texas, where a federal jury Friday convicted 8 anti-ICE protesters on terrorism charges in a closely watched trial that's raised fears over the Trump administration's intensifying crackdown on activists and First Amendment rights. This marked the first time terrorism charges were successfully brought against activists by the Justice Department, as federal prosecutors accused the protesters of being members of Antifa. The trial focused on a shooting that happened during a protest outside the Prairieland ICE jail in Alvarado, Texas, last year. A total of 9 protesters stood trial at a packed Fort Worth courtroom, facing an array of federal charges, including attempted murder. The protesters were also indicted on state criminal charges. For more, we go to Charlotte, North Carolina, where we're joined by Javier Dejanon, an attorney with the People's Law Collective and the National Lawyers Guild, has provided legal assistance to the DFW Support Committee, a coalition that's assisting over a dozen activists who were arrested at the Prairieland protest last July. He represents one of the defendants, Elizabeth Soto, in the state case. Soto and 7 others involved in the Prairieland protest were convicted Friday on federal terrorism and other charges. Thank you so much for being with us, Javier. If you can start off by explaining what happened that day and what these charges are that these 8 protesters were convicted of and what they face.
Good morning. Yes, happy to be here and to be able to give more information. I think after the trial that I was able to see in some weeks, I wanted to present what happened based on some of the protesters' perspective. I mean, what happened on July 4th, 2025 was a noise demonstration. And we heard during the trial that if you were someone, you know, who was interested in immigrant justice, in immigrant rights in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and you happened to join a very large Signal group chat that had political announcements, events, and rallies, and so on, you would have found out about the noise demonstration on July 4th, 2025. And if you decided to go, you would have been there with other
Javier,
activists,
Javier, just to be clear, you're talking about a noise protest?
Yes, a noise demonstration. A noise demo is a very common type of protest that happens outside of prisons and jails. And usually they happen in loud days, right? 4th of July, New Year's Eve, and what people do outside is just literally noise. The purpose is to get people inside to remember that they're not forgotten, that they are seen, that they are heard. And that is what was happening on July 4th. There was a flyer, noise demonstration, come make noise. What was different is that there were fireworks. And for me, this isn't so uncommon. I have seen noise demos across the country that also feature fireworks, but it was after the fireworks were shot that around the facility that the people inside, the wardens, called 911. The fireworks did not damage anything. This was very clear on trial. The fireworks did not even hit any fence, any part of the buildings. It was raining that day. But unfortunately, as people were leaving, that was seen on the videos, we heard from the officers, people were leaving as the police was arriving. One of the office, the first arriving officer from Alvarado Police Department, got off his car, drew his firearm at some of the protesters, and then shots were fired in his direction. And then the officer shot back. So what happened was a noise demonstration that anyone could have gone to, and unfortunately, shots fired back and forth after the officer drew his firearm. The charges, unfortunately, were not only material support for terrorism, they were a riot, they were using explosives in the commission of a felony, the fireworks, and then an arraigned of attempted murder charges, which of all those charges, only one person was found guilty, the person alleged to have shot the rifle.
And Javier, could you talk about the federal prosecutor's attempt to accuse all of the protesters of being part of Antifa?
Yes. So what we heard from the federal government since July 4th, 2025, is descriptions that are similar to what we're hearing in Minneapolis, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in Portland, and now in Vermont, that people who are standing up for immigrants are terrorists, are Antifa, are masked villains, are wearing black to be disguised and never been found. During the trial, we heard repeatedly the reference to something they call the North Texas Antifa cell. The Department of Justice still says this is a thing. But then we heard from cooperating defendants explaining that no such thing exists, that they didn't even know that they were a part of Antifa to begin with, as the government alleges. So this case, although it is the federal government's first successful Antifa trial, it actually didn't even need Antifa to have any convictions. The convictions, riot, material support for terrorism, attempted murder, use of explosives, don't even need an organization or that there is even a terrorist organization. The Antifa of it all, from my perspective, was purely political. And we saw that from the so-called expert that the government used.
And we have only a minute, but could you talk about some of the witnesses for the prosecution and their connections to right-wing organizations?
Yes. So really the biggest witness that the prosecution presented was Kyle Scheidler, I believe is his last name. And he was presented as the expert on Antifa for the government. He actually works for a think tank that has been considered a hate group. And the director of that think tank has been exposed as being Islamophobic and having all these very right-wing, very conservative beliefs. This person got on the stand and he actually admitted that he helped write the indictment for the federal government. So the so-called expert on Antifa, which even the judge wasn't impressed about, was also the one who wrote this Antifa indictment for the federal government. I mean, beside him, we had dozens and dozens of officers from every imaginable agency, FBI, ATF, Alvarado Police, Johnson County, other towns police, all called on the scene after the shooting occurred, after the July 4th noise demonstration.
Javier, we just have 15 seconds. What happens next? They've been convicted of terrorism, 8 of these protesters facing at least 15 years in jail each.
Yes. What's next is that the fight continues. There will be post-trial motions. There will likely be appeals. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of state cases that are still pending, not just for these defendants, but for other defendants that never had federal charges from the same event. And so the battle will go on in North Texas, and hopefully more people can support the supporters through their own resources, through
Javier,
attorney connections.
Javier, we're going to have to leave it there. Javier de Hanon, attorney with the People's Law Collective National Lawyers Guild. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
Ashanti dreams of writing wonderful books. Tomas dreams of building the cities of the future. Cassie dreams of going home, of sleeping in her own bed, of turning 10.
Right now in Canada, more than 10,000 children are being treated for cancer, and one in five will not survive. When you support Childhood Cancer Canada, you help fund critical research and provide financial assistance to families in their fight. Give life to dreams beyond kids' cancer at livefordreams.ca.